Morning or good evening, good afternoon, wherever you may be. So welcome to the, this will be a review of Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Deeds, or Engaging in the Bodhisattva's Deeds, I don't know, different translations. And today we'll be looking at the second chapter, chapter two. So when the Buddha and other Buddhas gave teachings, and also Bodhisattvas such as Shantideva, whose text we are studying, so when they gave teachings, when they shared the Dharma, their motivation was altruistic, bodhicitta. They were thinking of all living beings throughout space with nothing but pure love and compassion, not the slightest bit of impatience or anger, aversion, judgmentalness, but just totally open-hearted compassion for every living being, wanting to help each and every one of us be free of our suffering and find the perfect peace of enlightenment. So when we listen to teachings, it's good to try and have that kind of motivation ourselves. Even though, you know, we're not Buddhas, we're not yet Bodhisattvas, but to try to have a similar state of mind, that we want to benefit all living beings, bring them peace and happiness, free them from suffering. And we want to learn how to do that better and better. So do your best to have that motivation as your reason for participating in this session, learning these teachings for the benefit of yourself and everyone else. So before I go on with doing a review of the text, I was thinking about the question that came up at the end of last week's class. The question was something about having doubt that a bodhisattva really is able to help all sentient beings. And I think it's understandable to have such a doubt. For one thing, most of us weren't probably not brought up in a Buddhist family, in a Buddhist society, where we would hear about bodhisattvas and their wonderful deeds from the time we were very young. We only hear about them when we're later in our life, when we're in our teens or 20s or even older. So it might be easier for, say, Tibetans or Chinese or Vietnamese who were brought up in a Buddhist culture to have faith in bodhisattvas and not have doubt in their abilities. Also, in our Western culture, we usually want to have like proof, evidence, you know, hard, concrete proof about something before we believe in it. And as far as I know, there is no proof of that nature that a bodhisattva can help all living beings, or even proof that bodhisattvas exist. Difficult to prove that somebody is a bodhisattva by just looking at their brain, measuring their brain. So without such proof, it can be hard to believe 100% in these things. But on the other hand, what I do with myself when I have doubt like this, I ask myself, can I disprove it? Can I prove that there is no such thing as a bodhisattva and that bodhisattvas can't help all living beings? So I don't think we can prove that. And so if we can't disprove the existence of such things. That means they might be true. So it's better to keep an open mind and think, yeah, maybe it's not true, but maybe it is true. Try not to reject it outright. And also, I was thinking that somebody who does aspire to become a bodhisattva and travel the bodhisattva path to enlightenment probably doesn't do this with this very clear, detailed plan about how they are going to help each and every sentient being all the way to enlightenment. So, for example, Venerable Semkhe, they're probably not looking at Venerable Semkhe and thinking, okay, right now she's at this point in her spiritual development, and at such and such time she will be at that point, and then I will do this and help her get to that level, and so on and so forth. You know, they've got, I don't think they have that all planned out for each and every sentient being. I mean, maybe a Buddha can do that. A Buddha is able to see past, present, future, and everything about sentient beings. But as a bodhisattva, they're not yet able to do that. So I think that, you know, they just cultivate this very strong wish, intention, to help each and every sentient being based on compassion, seeing how they suffer, and also seeing how each sentient being has been kind to me. They've been my mother, they've been my father, they've done this, they've done that. So I am dependent on each and every sentient being for my own happiness. And also that every sentient being has Buddha nature, because the defilements, the obscurations that prevent our mind becoming enlightened are temporary, transitory. They're not permanent. They're not permanent fixtures in our mind. So they can be cleared away. And they probably have very strong faith and conviction that once they become enlightened Buddhas, they will be able to help each sentient being, even if they're limited right now. But they believe that, you know, once they get beyond these limitations and become enlightened, then they can help all sentient beings because of the amazing abilities and powers of a Buddha. So these are listed in the teachings. There's a long list of these powers and abilities that the Buddha has. So one example is what are called the 10 powers or 10 strengths of a Buddha. I don't know if you've heard about these, probably have. It doesn't hurt to go through them again. I can never remember them. And these are both in the Pali tradition as well as in the Sanskrit tradition. So they're not just in the Mahayana tradition. They're also mentioned in the Pali texts. So these 10 are exceptional knowledges. So they're actually wisdoms. They're states of mind that are unique to a Buddha. Only a Buddha has them. And they enable a Buddha to perform the special functions of a Buddha, such as establishing the teachings in the world, teaching sentient beings in a skillful way, and leading them to awakening. And there's different versions of these, both in the Pali and the Sanskrit. They're sometimes in a different order or explained a bit differently. So I'm going to take this version from the book Meditation on Emptiness by Jeffrey Hopkins. So you can look that up if you want to know more detail. So I'll just go through these 10 quickly. The first one is called Knowledge of Sources and Non-Sources. So this is direct knowledge of cause and effect, how cause and effect works, both within samsara, cyclic existence. For example, how virtue leads to happiness, non-virtue leads to suffering, but also how cause and effect work in terms of getting out of cyclic existence, like how we follow the path and achieve the various fruits, the results. The second is direct knowledge of the fruition of actions. So this is again related to karma, but it's more the general characteristics of karma, like how karma is definite. These are mentioned in the Lam Rim, those four general characteristics. Karma is definite, karma increases, it's never lost, and we don't experience results if we haven't created the cause. So Buddha has direct knowledge of these four facts of karma. And the third is knowledge of those who are superior and those who are inferior in terms of their mental development, like, you know, who has cultivated certain positive qualities, excellent qualities in their minds, and who have less of these excellent qualities, and also who has faith, virtuous qualities like faith, who has heavier afflictions, and so on. So Buddha is able to see the minds of all beings and know kind of what's going on in their mind in terms of their positive and not so positive qualities. And the fourth is the knowledge of the varieties of dispositions. So this is knowing, like, different sentient beings have inclinations towards different paths. You know, some are more inclined to the hearer path, others to the bodhisattva path. Perhaps also knowing that some are more inclined to other religions beside Buddhism, like a theistic religion, because it said a Buddha will teach according to the levels of beings. And even for those who believe in a god, who believe in Allah or Brahma, the Buddha will teach them according to that, just to help them get further in their spiritual development. And then the fifth is knowledge of the varieties of trainees' interests in the various great and small vehicles. Okay, so this is also related to the different paths that sentient beings are inclined towards. And the sixth, also about paths, knowledge of the paths proceeding within cyclic existence, the different rebirths, like what is the cause for being reborn in a particular realm in cyclic existence, and also the paths that lead out of cyclic existence and to the different goals of the hearers, the solitary realizers, and the bodhisattvas. So Buddha fully knows all the paths leading to these different results. And the seventh is knowledge of the different concentrations, like the meditative stabilizations, the four jhanas, and so on. So there's all the, it gets very complicated in the text, these different mental states that can be achieved on the basis of calm abiding. And then eighth is knowledge mindful of former states. So this is the Buddha's ability to see all the past lives of both him or herself and everyone else. So the Buddha can see everybody's past lives, everything we've ever done, every rebirth we've ever had, and so on. It's all open to the Buddha's mind. And the ninth is knowledge of one's own and others' deaths and rebirths. So this has to do with the future. Buddha can see when we're going to die, how and when, and how we're going to take rebirth, where we're going to take rebirth, and so on. So that's, again, known to the Buddha's mind. And the tenth is called knowledge of the extinction of all contaminations. So this is referring to how the Buddha, a Buddha, any Buddha, has eliminated all the obscurations, both the afflictive obscurations that prevent nirvana, and also the obscurations that prevent omniscience, the cognitive obscurations. So Buddha's mind is totally free of all of that. So these are just some of the qualities that a Buddha has. There's many others that one achieves when attaining enlightenment. And having these qualities means that a Buddha is able to help others with, you know, incredible qualities and abilities. And so a bodhisattva would have confidence that this is possible, that they can achieve these qualities and then be able to help other sentient beings. So they aspire for that. They aspire to become Buddhas. And they create the causes for it. And I'm also sure that as they progress along the path, as their own mind gets more and more pure and clear, then their conviction in the possibility of becoming enlightened and helping all living beings would grow stronger and stronger, because they can actually see the results of the practice, you know. And I'm sure we have that experience as well. We can see that having done whatever practices we have done, we have made some improvement in certain areas. We are better than we before we started. So when you see the results of practice, that gives you encouragement, conviction, that if you keep going, then you'll get better and better. So I think this is one way to deal with a doubt like this, is just to learn more about the path and reflect, and also meditate and practice and see for yourself that these kind of practices do help you improve your ability to help others. And then that gives you the enthusiasm to practice more and more and more and more. So it's like, a way to overcome doubt and have enthusiasm to continue practicing. So I hope that's helpful. So last week, we looked at the first chapter. We did a review of the first chapter, which explains the benefits of bodhicitta and also the two kinds of bodhicitta, wishing and engaging bodhicitta. So learning about those points will hopefully give us enthusiasm to want to work on cultivating bodhicitta. But we also need to uphold or maintain whatever amount of bodhicitta or altruism we have developed. And the commentary I was looking at by Drukpa Gyaltsen says that to maintain our bodhicitta, two things are needed. One is confessing negativities and obscurations. So clearing away our negative karma and obscurations, because these are adverse conditions for cultivating bodhicitta. These are things that obstruct, hinder our development of bodhicitta. So they need to be cleared out of the way. And the second thing is we need to accumulate the two collections of merit and wisdom. So that's like adding fuel, adding energy to our cultivation of bodhicitta, enabling us to go further and further in that direction. So those are favorable conditions for generating bodhicitta. So the first of these two, confessing negativities and obscurations, is explained in chapter 2. And the second one, the collection of merit and wisdom, is explained in chapter 3. So chapter 2 then, the title, I guess it's translated differently. It's confessing negativities. In Stephen Batchelor's it's called disclosure of evil. So anyway, the idea is confession of negative things that we've done. And it's kind of a long chapter. It's got 65 verses, so I won't talk about every single verse. I'll just kind of read through many of them. So again, the purpose of confessing and purification of our negativities and obscurations is to clear those out of the way, because they are adverse conditions for cultivating bodhicitta. They are things that stand in the way of our cultivation of bodhicitta. So why do you think that is? Why is it that if we don't confess and purify our negativities, that will hinder our ability to cultivate bodhicitta?
Off the top of my head, that I know that the more I respond to my afflictive state of minds and act out in them, I do all these things that certainly not only help me, but they don't help anybody else. So I'm endangering my own good possibilities, potential, as well as harming those who come in relationship to me. So it's not supportive any way, shape, or form.
That sounds good. Sounds right, true.
We can waste a lot of time just regretting our bad actions or dwelling on negativity and just thinking about ourselves and not thinking about others.
Yeah, I mean, it is good, of course, to feel regret and do purification, but yeah, to keep feeling that again and again, worrying, anxious, feeling bad, it's a waste of time and energy. So the ideal thing is to confess and purify and then leave it aside and move forward.
That was an explanation that I heard that was very helpful for me with this they were explaining the Tibetan term about the non-disclosure like things that literally things that you cannot speak of. And that that term, how well, if I look at it as in the many layers, like it's just things that is part of the mind that is in darkness, or it's things that I don't want to look at, and then to be able to bring them into the light, to be able to look at them, then they lose, because in shadows things takes on, like you have a misperception of things, you see the rope as a snake, and so that was very helpful in a different explanation of why are you revealing, why are you confessing, so that you can then see reality clearer, and that helps you with the practice of bodhicitta in seeing how interconnected things are. Yeah, so that was I had not heard the explanation like that, but it was a very literal way of explaining that was very helpful for me.
While you were talking, I was thinking about Jung's explanation of the shadow. Yeah, he says there's these parts of ourself that we don't acknowledge, you know, negative things, faults or whatever. They can be positive things as well, but there's a lot of negative things in there that we just want to avoid and not deal with. And they're kind of, the idea of a shadow, they're in the dark. And one result of that, if we do that, we tend to project them on other people. We project our negativities on others and see lots of faults in everybody else, but not see them in ourselves. So yeah, it can lead to lots of problems. We don't acknowledge and confess and clear up our own faults and negativities.
And the explanation was that it's what you could not speak of it, like you couldn't name it, and that was very helpful in that for me, in that being able to name things, make them less scary, make them also less kind of twisted, and you don't have to add layers.
Mm-hmm.
That was very helpful for me. Like just, it was a very simple explanation, but it took away a lot of that criticalness of the confession explanation and all that. Just be able to speak about it.
Yeah, that's good.
To have words for it.
Yeah, that's less scary. Chuni.
Think of this quite. It literally, and it's kind of a cartoon image, but it is this picture that as long as that stuff is in my mind, there's not room for anything else. So you have to open the door and just let it out so that then the love and compassion or whatever good qualities can grow.
Mm. Yeah, cluttered mind, like a cluttered attic or basement. Yeah. And also just the fact that, you know, it's going to take a while. Many lifetimes to follow the bodhisattva's path and reach enlightenment. And we got to make sure that in our future lives we are in good conditions. Human rebirth or God rebirth or Pure Land rebirth, where we can again meet the teachings and put them into practice. We don't want to go backwards into the unfortunate realms, animal and so forth. That's going the opposite direction, away from enlightenment. And so if we commit a lot of negativities and we don't purify them, then they can be the cause for us to have bad rebirths in future lives. And so we don't want that. So that's another reason why that is so important to do, to be able to, you know, move forward in a positive direction, life after life after life, towards enlightenment. Okay, so, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, they have these practices they call ngundro, preliminary practices. They're mainly done in the context of tantra, to prepare oneself for the practice of tantra. But, you know, it's also for the practice of the bodhisattva's path. And I was thinking that maybe they could be compared to the training of an athlete. If an athlete wants to compete in the Olympics, then there are certain things they need to do. They need to you know, get rid of some bad habits and other obstacles, like maybe excess fat on their body, eating junk food, taking drugs, laziness, or lack of self-confidence. So these are things they need to clear away, obstacles to what it is they wish to achieve. So there's, you know, the clearing away of these obstacles. And then in addition to that, there's the building up of confidence, positive qualities, confidence, good health, muscles, energy, and so on, training, of course. So only by doing those things will they actually have a chance, even a chance of competing in the Olympics. So it's kind of similar, you know, we're in for a really long, hard journey to go all the way to enlightenment. So we got to make ourselves fit. We have to get rid of things that are in the way, obstacles, and we need to build up positive factors that will enhance our following of this path. So maybe that's one way of looking at the Ngundro practices, which are basically for purifying, clearing away the negative energy, and building up the positive energy. Okay, so the first part of this chapter, first 22 verses actually, are offerings, making offerings to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And it's said that this is one of the best ways to accumulate merit, positive energy. So here we also, in this chapter, we also have some ways of accumulating merit as well as purifying. So I'll just read quickly through these. In order to uphold that precious mind, I make excellent offerings to the Tathagatas, to the sacred Dharma, the stainless jewel, and to the children of the Buddhas, the oceans of excellent qualities. So these are the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha within Mahayana, making offerings to them. And then he goes through all these wonderful offerings, whatever flowers and fruits there are, and whatever kinds of medicine, whatever jewels exist in this world, and whatever clean, refreshing waters, jewel mountains, and likewise forest groves, quiet and joyful places, heavenly trees ornamented by and bedecked with flowers, and trees with branches laden with good fruit, fragrances and incense of the realms of gods, wish-fulfilling trees and jewel trees, uncultivated harvests, and all ornaments that are worthy to be offered, lakes and pools adorned with lotuses and the beautiful cry of wild geese, everything unowned within the limitless spheres of space. Taking these with my mind, I offer them to the supreme beings, the Munis, these are the Buddhas, as well as their children, the Bodhisattvas. O holy objects of offering, compassionate ones, think mercifully of me and accept these offerings of mine. I find that the practice of making offerings, whether it's done physically, actually putting things on the altar, or doing it mentally, visualizing, it's so uplifting for the mind. It really makes your mind kind of light and clear and pure and happy. I mean, it's meant to accumulate merit, but it does have a very good effect, kind of an immediate good effect on the mind. And then he says, not having merit, I am destitute, and I have no other gifts to offer. So they say that even if you're destitute, you can offer mentally, you can visualize, imagine many beautiful offerings, the things that actually exist in this world, like all the beautiful national parks in our country and the beautiful gardens and flowers and so on. Just whatever beautiful things you can think of, and just imagine those filling all the space, and then mentally offer them to the Buddha. So even if you're poor, you don't have any money, you can still make offerings. Thus, O protectors, you who think of others' welfare through your power, accept these for my sake. Eternally, I shall offer all my bodies. So this is helpful to overcome attachment to our body. I mean, we're fortunate to have this human body that we have, but it's not helpful to be attached to it. That becomes another obstacle. So we can think of offering our body as a kind of servant to the Buddhas, to be a follower of the Buddhas. So offering the body to the conquerors and their children, Please accept me, you supreme heroes. Respectfully shall I be your subject. Through being completely under your care, I shall not fear conditioned existence and shall benefit sentient beings. I shall perfectly transcend my previous negativities and henceforth shall commit no more. So by offering ourselves, putting ourselves under the compassionate care and guidance of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, following their teachings, being a follower of them, then there are all these benefits that we'll experience. We will be without fear of samsara, we'll benefit others, we'll be able to get beyond our negativities and, of course, create a lot of merit. The next set of verses is the practice of offering bath. So probably most of you are familiar with this practice. It's included in the Nyungne. And it might seem kind of strange to offer bath to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I mean, do they need that? Are they dirty? Are they not? Because their bodies are made of light, completely pure. They don't have any dirt, any defilements to wash away. But it's symbolic. It's symbolic of purifying our own defilements. So it's said to be a really good practice for clearing our own negativities. To very sweetly scented bathing chambers with brilliantly sparkling crystal floors and exquisite pillars ablaze with gems, having canopies above aglow with pearls, I beseech the Tathagatas and their children to come and bathe their bodies abundantly from many jeweled vases filled with waters scented and enticing to the accompaniment of song and music. So this beautiful visualization of this beautiful bathing house, you know, jewels everywhere and beautiful music playing and waters being poured from jeweled vases, and there's beautiful offering goddesses doing all this. So it's kind of a really beautiful visualization. Let me dry their bodies with incomparable cloths, clean and well anointed with scent, and then may I present them with fragrant, well-dyed garments. So then we imagine them being dried and presented with fresh, beautiful, celestial garments. Manifold, thin, and soft clothes I adorn with hundreds of this and that supreme ornaments, the Aryas, Samantabhadra, Manjugosha, Avalokiteshvara, and so forth. By polishing pure, refined gold, I anoint the bodies of the lords of subduers that blaze with light with the choicest perfumes whose fragrance permeates throughout the billion worlds. So we offer them fresh clothing and ornaments and fragrant oils. And to the highest objects of giving, the lords of subduers, I offer all enchanting, sweet-smelling flowers, such as mandara, lotus, and upala, and beautiful, well-arranged garlands. I also offer clouds of incense, whose pervasive sweet aroma steals away the mind. I offer to them the delicacies of the gods, with a variety of foods and drinks, too. I also offer them jeweled lamps arranged on golden lotus buds. Upon ground anointed with incense, I scatter loose, pleasing flowers. To those who have the nature of compassion, I offer inestimable palaces resounding with melodious praises, beautified by and blazing with hanging ornaments of gems of pearls that adorn the infinite space. So these are some of the traditional offerings that are made in various pujas and probably coming from the Indian culture, you know, beautiful palaces and delicious foods and flower garlands and so on and so forth. These are the kind of things that would be offered to kings and members of the royalty and, of course, to the Buddhas and so on. Eternally shall I offer to the lords of subduers jeweled parasols with golden handles and pleasing ornaments embellishing the rims, standing upright, their shapes beautiful to behold. Besides those, may collections of offerings resounding with sweet, pleasing music, clouds that appease the suffering of sentient beings, remain individually. May a rain of flowers and gems descend continuously upon all the Dharma jewels and upon the reliquaries and holy images. So not only are we making offerings to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but also the Dharma jewels, so we can imagine texts like we have in the meditation hall, all the scriptures, the Buddha's sutras and the commentaries and so on. And upon reliquaries, meaning like stupas, and holy images, Buddha images. So imagining offerings raining down onto them. In the same way as Manjugosha and so forth have made offerings to the victors, similarly do I bestow gifts upon the Tathagatas, the protectors, as well as their children. So those are all the verses of offerings. Very nice to read them slowly and visualize these offerings being made. And next are some verses of prostration, mainly with speech and with body and taking refuge. I eulogize the oceans of excellent qualities with oceans of branches of melodious praise. May these clouds of pleasant eulogy certainly arise always to them everywhere. So, of course, we can express in actual reality, praises, but we can also imagine praises being spoken, being expressed to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas with very beautiful voices and in very beautiful language. With bodies as numerous as all the atoms within the field, I bowed with my body to all Buddhas of three times the Dharma and the Supreme Community. So this is making offerings, prostrating with body. And next, I pay homage to the basis of the mind of enlightenment, to all supports of offering, to all abbots and masters, and to all the holders of supreme conduct. Until the essence of enlightenment, I go for refuge to the Buddhas, likewise I go for refuge to the Dharma, and to the assembly of Bodhisattvas. So next is the actual verses of confession. So this goes on for many verses. And I was thinking this morning that, you know, we've been hearing in the news recently lots of stories, accounts of misconduct done by others. You know, from relatively small things like people refusing to wear masks, to really heavy things like this horrible murder that just took place or that happened recently in our community, in our town, and the things happening around the world. So lots of acts of misconduct by others. And I don't know about you, but it's very easy for judgmentalness to come up in the mind. And when I look at that kind of mind, that judgmental mind, it seems arrogant, seems to be saying, I wouldn't do anything like that. I am not like that. So then you can look down on those who do such things. But Buddhism says we have done everything, not necessarily in this life, but in past lives. And in the past, I had difficulty accepting that. But gradually, the more I got familiar with my mind, observed my mind, the kind of thoughts and feelings, images that run through my mind, I have come to accept, somewhat reluctantly, that yes, I have done horrible things myself in the past, not necessarily this life, but in past lives. So I've come to accept that, yeah, I've done all those bad things. I've committed murders and rapes and torture and corrupt, you know, being greedy and manipulating others to increase my own wealth and power and so on. So I did all those things myself. And if you can accept that, then you realize that I'm not in any position to judge other people, to look down on other people for what they are doing. So it really tones down that judgmental mind. And also contemplating the suffering involved with those kind of actions, those kinds of attitudes in people's minds. For example, I was thinking about this murder that happened here, and you know, these young men who took this other young man, younger than them, and there was like a gang of them, I don't know, five or six of them. They got this young guy and tied him up and hit him over the head and killed him and then buried his body. I mean, just going through, thinking about that beforehand, even if it was something impulsive, still, it's something that would have taken a certain amount of time. So just going through that kind of action. And then it's done, and you have to live with that. You have to live with what you have done. And now they find themselves in jail, and they're probably going to face maybe a life sentence or a very long sentence in prison. So just so much suffering there. So when you contemplate that, then the only response that makes any sense is compassion, feeling compassion for them, and wishing that anyone who does harmful things like that, that they can come to acknowledge their wrongs, like Venerable Pema said, bringing it out of the dark, bringing it out of the shadow, bringing it into light, and recognizing this was a wrong thing to do, and feel regret, declare it, confess it, and purify it. And then make the resolution, from now on, I'm not going to do those actions again. I'm going to act ethically. So to have that wish for everyone who's doing harmful things, negative things, unethical things, to go through that kind of process. This is what is appropriate in this kind of situation, rather than being judgmental and critical. And then, of course, we need to do that ourselves. We need to be an example of that. We got plenty of things ourselves to purify. So if we can go through this process of purification ourselves, then it can be like an example and a role model for others to follow, and be able to help others to follow this kind of process. Okay, so he starts by saying, verse 27, with folded hands I request the complete Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who possess great compassion and reside in all directions. So I was going through these verses and trying to find the four powers. So this might be the power of refuge or power of reliance, relying on the three jewels. And then he starts the next power of feeling regret, declaring one's misdeeds with a feeling of regret. Since beginningless cyclic existence, in this life and in others, unknowingly, I committed negativities and caused them to be done. Overwhelmed by the mistakes of ignorance, I rejoiced in what was committed. So that's something else that we do. Sometimes we don't feel any regret. We do something negative and then we feel good about it, and may even want to do it again. Oh, that felt good. You know, I got a sense of power there. I want to feel that again. So we want to do it again instead of wanting to abstain or refrain. So that just makes it worse, more negative. But now, seeing these mistakes from my heart, I confess them to the protector. So here's the power of declaring one's negativities with regret. Whatever harmful acts of body, speech, and mind I have done by means of afflictions towards the three jewels, my parents, my spiritual masters, and others, all the terrible negativities done by me, a wrongdoer, who have created the faults of a multitude of misdeeds, I admit to the guides. And then there follows a number of verses reflecting on what will happen if I don't purify. What are the consequences of not regretting and acknowledging and confessing, purifying my misdeeds? I may die before my negativities have been purified. Please protect me in such a way as will swiftly and surely free me from them. And contemplating death, impermanence and death is very, very powerful. Powerful incentive to purify and not delay. Do it as quickly as possible. The untrustworthy Lord of Death, without waiting, whether or not something has been done, whether one is sick or otherwise, suddenly comes. Do not be complacent about life. Leaving all behind, I must depart alone. Through not having understood this, I committed various kinds of negativities for the sake of my friends and foes. Even my foes will become nothing. My friends will also become nothing. I too will become nothing. Likewise, all will become nothing. So I find those two verses very, very powerful. Just reminding ourselves of impermanence. We're getting older every day, every hour, every minute, every second. Our body is changing. The tiny particles in our body are changing and disintegrating. Our body is getting older and older and older. And at some point, you don't even have to wait until you're old, but at some point, this life is going to end. This body will no longer support our continuation of life, and we'll die. And not realizing that, not thinking about that, it's so easy to get caught up in the things of this life, our attachments, our aversions, our likes, our dislikes, and things seem so important. I have to act on this. I have to say something. I have to do something motivated by attachment or aversion. But then we create karma, and that's the only thing that's actually going to go with us. When this life ends and we go to the next life, we leave behind all the people in our life, all the important people, our friends, our loved ones, our pets, and our enemies. You know, we're going to leave all them behind. And they're also going to die. They may die before we do. So, you know, these relationships we have with them are so impermanent, so ephemeral, so transitory. And yet not realizing that, seeing them as super important, we get caught up in these afflictive emotions and then do actions, many of them negative actions. But if we think all of these things are going to become nothing, go out of existence, then that's a really powerful incentive to stop creating negative karma and purify the karma that we have created. And also, you know, if we don't purify our negative karma before we die, then we might find ourselves heading to a bad place, an unfortunate rebirth. So talks about that in the next verses. Just like an experience in a dream, whatever things I enjoy will become a memory. Whatever has passed will not be seen. So that's another helpful way of thinking about life. You know, at the time of death, even before we die, looking back on our life, everything can seem like a dream. We might even wonder, did that really happen or was that a dream? And in a way, it is like a dream because it's all fading and disappearing. And, you know, we're going into another state, another experience. So thinking of life like a dream is very helpful to not take things so seriously. So just like an experience in a dream, whatever things I enjoy will become a memory. Whatever has passed will not be seen. Even within this brief life, many friends and foes have passed away, but whatever terrible negativities I committed for them remains before me. Well, some of our friends and foes have already gone, but we may have committed negative actions in relation to those, and that negative karma is still there. And if we don't purify it, we're going to be in trouble. Thereby, through not having realized that I will suddenly vanish, I committed many negativities through ignorance, attachment, and hatred. Remaining neither night nor day, this life is always slipping by and never lengthening. I find it helpful to think of life as being like being on a train or other vehicle, you know, that just continuously going towards a destination. Never stops, and we can't get off. We're stuck on this vehicle, and it's going to take us to the end of our life, death. No choice. So whether it's 100 years or 1 year or 1 day, we're going to get there eventually. And we can't extend our life. Why will death not come to one like me? While I am lying in bed, although surrounded by my friends and relatives, the feeling of life being severed will be experienced by me alone. So no matter how much people love us and care for us and want us to be happy, but if in our mind we're lying there in our deathbed, you know, feeling afraid, nobody can really understand how we feel, and nobody can share that experience with us or take that experience away from us. So we're kind of alone in that experience. So he's describing kind of a worst case scenario here of, you know, what could happen at the time of death if we don't purify, if we haven't purified our negative karma. When seized by Yamas, the Lord of Death's messengers, what benefit will friends and relatives afford? My merit alone shall protect me then, but upon that I have never relied. Well, hopefully this won't be the case. At the time of death, hopefully. I shouldn't say hopefully. We're keeping our vows. We are creating a lot of merit. But if we don't, then things will be bad. O protectors, I, so unconscientious, unaware of such terror as this, performed many negativities for the sake of this impermanent life. One who is being led today to the spot where his limbs will be mutilated will be petrified with dry mouth, sunken eyes, and so forth. His entire appearance is transfigured. What need to mention the tremendous despair when being stricken with a disease of terror, being clasped by the frightful physical forms of the messengers of Yama? Who can afford me good protection from this terror? With terrified, bulging eyes agape, I shall search the four directions for refuge. Maybe I'm wondering, like, realistically, how many people die this way with terror. I can't help but think maybe nowadays people who die in hospitals or nursing homes. They might be in a coma. They might be medicated, sedated. Although we don't know what's going on in their mind, they might be lying there looking very peaceful and calm. But maybe in their mind, there are all these terrifying visions and experiences. I did have the experience once when I was in Singapore. This family asked me to go and visit one family member, a woman who was dying of cancer. And I think I visited her a few times to say prayers and, you know, try to offer some help, some comfort. And one night I got this call. They said, oh, please come, please come. And so I went. She was in the hospital, and it was kind of a big room, like a ward with many other beds, many other patients. And she was lying there, and she was going through some kind of bad experience. She was like writhing and tossing and turning and crying out. And I tried to talk to her, and she just seemed totally oblivious to anything around her. She was in her own world, hellish, it seemed, world. And I didn't, you know, I did some prayers and mantras and tried to talk to her, but didn't seem to be doing much good. So eventually I left. But then the next day or two, the family again called me and said, oh, please come, please come. So this time, I think she may have already died by the time I got there, but they said she was peaceful. So she went through that horrible experience and eventually calmed down and was calm and peaceful at the actual time that she died. But for me, that was, you know, a firsthand experience of how someone can have really frightening, I don't know what was going on with her, but yeah, frightening experiences, and it would be very tragic, very unfortunate to be in that state of mind at the time of death, but I guess it can happen. So now he's talking about refuge, how we learn to take refuge and develop this practice of refuge that can give us hope and confidence and the ability to put our minds into a positive state at the time of death. So if we haven't done that, next verse, 46, he says, then seeing no refuge in the four directions, I shall become enveloped in gloom. If there should be no refuge there at that time, what shall I do? So if we haven't developed this practice of refuge and, you know, learned how to take refuge in the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha, then at that point in time, we might be looking around for someone to take refuge in and not find anyone because we haven't cultivated that. So it's very, very important. You know, like there's lots of practices that can be done at the time of death, but some of them are quite complicated and require a lot of practice during life. But refuge, the taking of refuge is not such a difficult thing. I think that's relatively easy for anyone to do. So just really get, of course, ideally we have a good understanding of the qualities of the three objects of refuge and what it means to take refuge and why we take refuge. So ideally we do it with a lot of understanding and sincerity. But there's also stories in the Tibetan tradition of people like in Tibet who didn't really cultivate the practice of refuge, but they knew about it. Just being in a Buddhist society, they knew about refuge and they would take refuge at times of fear, times of danger, and it would benefit them, even though maybe it was just from their mouth, you know, just saying the words, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, help me. And, you know, even in that, at that level, it can still be very, very helpful. So in the next verses, he does talk about sincere refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So verse 47 says, therefore, from today onwards, I go for refuge to the victors, the protectors of migrating beings who strove for the purpose of protecting migrating beings and with great power eradicate all fear. So that's taking refuge in the Buddha. And then, likewise, I perfectly go for refuge to the Dharma they have realized. So they say there's two aspects of Dharma. There's the Dharma of scriptures and Dharma of realizations. Dharma of scriptures would be the actual teachings of the Buddha, and then the Dharma of realizations are the mental states, the actual realizations in the mind of the Buddhas and the Aryas. So the Dharma that they have realized that clears away the fears of cyclic existence and also to the assembly of bodhisattvas. So that's the refuge in the Dharma, refuge in the Sangha, the Arya Sangha, Bodhisattva Sangha. And then he goes on to mention a number of the bodhisattvas, the famous bodhisattvas. I, terrified, offer myself to Samantabhadra, to Manjugosha also, I offer my body to the protector Avalokiteshvara, who unmistakably acts with compassion. I utter a mournful cry, please protect this wrongdoer. In my search for refuge, I cry from my heart to Akashagarbha, Kshitigarbha, and all the compassionate protectors. And I go for refuge to Vajrapani, upon the side of whom all hateful beings, such as the messengers of Yama, flee in terror to the four directions. So he mentioned six of the eight bodhisattvas. There's this group of eight bodhisattvas, bodhisattva disciples of the Buddha. So he mentioned six, and I think the ones he didn't mention are Maitreya, and there's one called Nivarana Vishkambini. Not so famous, but anyway, there's a group of eight bodhisattvas. But of course, there's many other bodhisattvas as well. And then verse 53, previously I transgressed your words, but now upon seeing this great fear, I go to you for refuge. By doing so, please swiftly clear away this fear. So I was wondering if this section of taking refuge in the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas might be the power of remedy, because taking refuge is definitely something very virtuous and an antidote to negative karma. And then he continues, if I need to comply with a doctor's advice when frightened by an ordinary illness, then what need to mention that it is so when perpetually diseased by the hundreds of faults of attachment and so forth? If all the people dwelling in Jambudvipa, our world, can be crushed by just one of these meaning faults like attachment, so afflictive emotions, and if no other medicine to cure them is to be found in all the directions, then the intention not to act in accordance with the words that can uproot every misery of the all-knowing physician is extremely bewildered and an object of scorn. So he's saying that, you know, if we get ill, even an ordinary illness, and to be cured, to recover, we need to rely on the doctor, the advice of the doctor, the medicine given by the doctor. So if that is the case with ordinary illnesses, then when it comes to the illnesses of all of our mental afflictions, they are like sicknesses. They are like sicknesses, mental sicknesses. When our mind gets taken over by attachment or by anger, by arrogance, jealousy, or a combination of different afflictive emotions. Our mind is like sick. It's a sick state of mind, diseased state of mind. So naturally we should rely on the doctor, in this case the Buddha. The Buddha is sometimes called the supreme physician, the all-knowing physician, because he knows what suffering, what sickness we are suffering from, and he knows the cure. He knows how we can recover from our mental illnesses, our mental afflictions. So if these teachings are available, the Dharma is like the medicine to cure all the afflictive emotions and all the suffering that arise from afflictions and karma. So Buddha's teachings are like the perfect cure to be free of all of this. So if we don't rely on his words, on his teachings, it's like throwing away the medicine. It's like if they find a vaccine for COVID, hopefully they have now, and if it all just gets dumped in the ocean, nobody wants to take it, something like that, you know, we don't use that medicine that can cure this terrible illness, or at least, you know, prevent people from getting this illness in the first place, that would be great, very, very tragic. So even more so would be tragic to refuse to follow the Buddha's teachings, which can cure us from all our suffering and causes of suffering. And he gives another analogy. 57, if I need to be conscientious near a small, ordinary precipice, not many people, well, I shouldn't say not many, there are some people who don't seem to be concerned about that kind of thing. What do they call them? Those people who go out on these ledges and take selfies of themselves standing on this ledge, you know, hundreds of feet above the ground, and sometimes they fall, but I just, I mean, just looking at those pictures, like, it makes me feel scared. So anyway, some people aren't very conscientious about being near an ordinary precipice, but probably most people are. Okay, so then how much more so near the precipices of long duration that drop for thousands of yojanas? So he's talking about the lower realms. So like at the time of death, that is, or can be, like being on the edge of a precipice, much worse than standing at the edge of the highest mountain or the highest building in the world. And yeah, because if we fall from that precipice into one of the unfortunate realms, especially into hell, then that we can be stuck there for a long, long time and experience much worse suffering than falling from a high place. So it is inappropriate to stay happily thinking, today alone I shall not die, for inevitably the time will come when I shall go out of existence. So if we keep thinking, I'm not going to die today, I'm not going to die today, that we can keep doing that right up to the day when we will actually die, if we make a habit of that, and that's when we're fooling ourselves. So the Tibetan teachers, and I'm sure most Buddhist teachers, recommend that instead of thinking that, we should think, I might die today. I might die this hour. I might die this minute. Death could happen at any moment. And that will really keep us careful, conscientious, mindful about what we do, and really do the best we can to refrain from creating negativities. But of course, if we do have negative thoughts or do negative things, then we can purify them. It's not like the end of the world. 59, who will grant me fearlessness? How can I be surely freed from this? If I shall inevitably go out of existence, how can I remain in mental happiness? What remains with me now from the past experiences that have gone? Through my adherence to them, I have gone against my spiritual master's advice. So we've had pleasant experiences in the past, but they're gone now. And if we cling to them, grasp at them, and try to relive them, get more of the same pleasure again and again and again, then this can lead us to again create causes of suffering and perpetuating our life in samsara. Leaving behind this life and likewise my friends and relatives, if all alone I must go elsewhere, how appropriate are friends and enemies? I mean, that doesn't mean we shouldn't have friends. We should make everybody our friend. See everyone as a friend, but not with attachment, not with clinging, not with unrealistic expectations and self-centered grasping, but just have a friendly attitude, a warm, kind attitude towards everyone. How can I be surely freed from non-virtue, the source of suffering? Continually, night and day, should I consider only this? So, instead of paying so much attention to other people's mistakes, misdeeds, non-virtuous actions, harmful actions, and so on, we should mainly focus on our own and really try to reduce the negative actions we do, purify the ones that we do, and work on deeper and deeper levels of our mind. So even the thought to do something negative, even a thought of anger or aversion or criticalness, really try to work on overcoming those, not letting those remain in our mind, and replace them with positive thoughts, virtuous thoughts, thoughts of loving kindness and compassion. So there's plenty of work we have to do just on ourselves, on our own minds. And I mean, of course we do, it doesn't mean we should just completely shut ourselves off from others and what they are doing, because If there is something we can do to stop or prevent other people doing harmful actions, then we should. And we can also look at others' non-virtuous actions and use that as a teaching. You know, oh, this is what I look like when I'm doing that, when I'm saying that, when I'm thinking that. Use it as a teaching on how to improve ourselves. But not get stuck in being critical and negative and judgmental. And I have to tell this to myself. Very hard to stop that. Okay, 63, almost to the end. Through unknowing and ignorance, whatever I have committed, be it a natural misdeed, so natural misdeeds are those actions that are negative for everyone, no matter who does them, such as killing, stealing, lying, and so forth, like the 10 non-virtuous actions. So no matter who does those actions, it's non-virtuous, negative. And then the next line mentions a stipulated negativity. That's this translation that I'm reading. And that refers to those of us who have taken precepts, vows. And like in our Pratimoksha vows, the vows of monks and nuns, many of the vows that we have are not naturally negative. They're not about things that are negative for everybody. But the Buddha said, those of us who are wearing robes, who are living an ordained life, monastic people, should not do those things. So, for example, there's lots of vows about how we wear our robes. We shouldn't wear them upside down and inside out and lopsided and so forth. So that kind of negativity only applies to monastics, but you know, it's not negative for a layperson to wear their clothes upside down or inside out or whatever. Yeah, so anyway, if we wanted to be a monastic and wear the robes of a Buddhist nun or monk, then we should refrain from those actions that the Buddha said should not be done by monastics. And if we do, that becomes something non-virtuous. So he's saying here, whatever I may have done, whether it's a natural misdeed or, because Shantideva was a monk, so he had those vows as well, those precepts. So all of those things that were specified for monastics to avoid, I confess all of these directly in the presence of the protectors, with folded hands, prostrating again and again, my mind terrified by suffering. I request the guides to please accept my negativities as being mistakes, since they are not good. I shall not do them again. So there's the last of the four powers, power of restraint or promise. I recognize that these actions were wrong, were mistaken, and I will not do them again to the best of my ability. Oh, I didn't think I'd be able to get through this whole thing. So this thing about fear, you know, a lot of these verses in this chapter have to do with fear of the consequences of the negative actions that we have done if we don't purify them. And as a teacher, when I'm teaching, especially introductory courses, I often encounter people saying that they don't like the idea of doing things out of fear. You've probably heard that as well, and maybe you've also felt it yourself. I can see the point of that. But on the other hand, if we look at the way we live our life and the things we do act often out of fear. When we drive, for example, right? We drive carefully. We follow the rules. We drive at the correct speed. We put on our seatbelt and look out for other cars and so on. This is out of fear of the consequences of not driving safely, not driving carefully. We've probably all seen accidents. Maybe some of us have been in accidents, so we know the terrible consequences. People can die. People can be horribly injured. Our car can be horribly damaged. You have to pay a lot of money to get it fixed. So we know these terrible consequences of not driving safely and carefully. So out of fear, ideally you're not sitting there terrified the whole time you're driving, but just with that in the back of the mind, you know, knowing I have to drive carefully. And so that's just one example, but other things as well. If you live in a place where there's poisonous snakes, you know, and certain places where they might hide, you just take care. You're cautious, you're careful in those situations to avoid that horrible experience of being bitten by a poisonous snake. So there's lots of areas in our life where we do actions or we avoid certain actions out of a kind of fear of the horrible consequences that would otherwise happen. So there's nothing wrong with acting out of fear, having, you know, a fear-based way of behaving. Because the fact is, in samsara, there are things to be afraid of. There are dangers. There are terrible things that can happen if we are not careful, if we don't take precautions. So this is just another area of that, another example of that. You know, the consequences of our actions, karmic consequences that may not happen immediately, but in the future. So out of fear of facing those consequences, then we live our life carefully. It doesn't mean living in constant terror and stress, but just that we know if I do this, that might happen. So I'm going to choose not to do that to the best of my ability. And if I happen to do it, if I happen to blow it, make a mistake, then it's possible to purify. Okay, so I'll stop there. We got a few minutes left if anyone has a question or if there's questions.
Even Batchelor's translation, he in this chapter has frequently used the phrase, I shall become nothing. And in your translation, the words were go out of existence, but those both don't really hit what's going on. I wonder what the Tibetan word is. And those both could be so misleading.
Becoming nothing.
Yeah, or going out of existence when actually those things don't actually happen.
Well, I think my understanding is he's just saying, like, I, who this present person who I am, Sangye Khadro, is going to become nothing. One day it'll just be a name. You know, people will talk about Sangye Khadro, who used to exist but isn't here anymore. So I think that's what he's talking about. I'm just going to, the present person that we are is going to disappear from this world. We don't normally think about that. We don't like to think about that. It's very uncomfortable, but we need to think about that. So I think that's what he means. I don't know what the Tibetan means.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, but I think if someone was just reading these verses without a commentary being given, they might read, I shall become nothing or go out of existence as just
nihilistic. Yeah. There's no rebirth. No. Right. Yeah. I don't think he's saying that because obviously he's talking about the precipice of long duration.
The Tibetan does say we'll become non-existent.
Yeah.
Mebalgyur.
I have to say, I take your point, but I have to say the words are pretty strong and it does make you like, think twice. By the way, it's written. It's poetic in that sense.
I'm looking at the commentary. He doesn't really say anything. He just says, yeah, we will all become nothing. But in the, you know, just before that, he talks about, I must depart alone to the next rebirth. So I think it's kind of understood that we're not talking about total annihilation of a person, but just the eye of this life going out of existence. Okay, so we'll stop there.